Okay, so we're going to start. Let's introduce Bharmati. Please join us. And Bharmati is a faculty fellow at New England Law in Boston, in Massachusetts, where she teaches IP-related things, copyright, trademarks, law, and the visual parts, so on. She has, as the author of a book, Cultivating Copyright: How Creative Industries Can Harness Intellectual Property to Survive the Digital Age, Routledge 2019. And she's come to visit us for quite a year, 8 months or something like that, in Cambridge, in order to do work on, particularly on women and feminism, authorship, and copyright. She is a member of all sorts of committees that I'm not going to read out, but that indicates that she's an important person. She has a JD from the University of Pennsylvania, an LLM, sorry, a JD from Michigan, and an LLM, an SJD, which is a Doctor of Juridical Science from the University of Pennsylvania. And she's going to talk to us tonight about something that excites all our law students, which is AI, and she's going to talk about transformative landscapes, how generative AI is shaping the contours of US copyright law and policy. And she will speak for about an hour.
It will be about an hour, sorry. So, thank you so much, Lionel, for the introduction, and thank especially to Sybil for having me, to the people who have been so welcoming to me here at Cambridge, and especially to all of you for showing up today at 5:30, an excruciatingly difficult hour because it's right before cocktails, is my understanding. But they are to come. I want to talk first about what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do. I'll do a little table setting and then we'll just jump in. Okay, so what I won't be covering is anything outside of the US context. I will be completely and totally focused today on US copyright law. And I think that this is a chance for you guys to get a little bit of an introduction to it. So I'll probably start by giving you a little bit of a table setting on what US copyright law is. I'm going to presume no knowledge of US copyright law on the part of anyone here. For those of you who have a deep knowledge, I know there's some people in the audience who do. Forgive me, this will be very basic for you, but I think it's important that we start with that. So, what you're basically getting is an American accent, American vernacular, and American law. All right. So, once in a while, that's kind of can be salutary, I think. This is the framework of what I'm going to cover today. I'm going to start with a little bit of context. As I said, I'm going to talk about the fair use doctrine, which is critical to generative AI cases. It really is the crux, not only of American copyright law, but of what's being contested. Then I'm going to talk about the pre-generative AI landscape, sort of where people are finding their precedents and how things are getting teed up. And then I'm going to do a survey and analysis of the generative AI training cases, of which there are really two right now that are predominant, Bards v. Anthropic and Cadre v. Meta. And I'll also talk a little bit about the In re OpenAI litigation and a little bit about other areas if I have time. And finally, I'll conclude with thoughts on what lies ahead. So, with no further ado, let's punch into this because it's a lot. This is the fair use doctrine in American law. This is Orisaes being pursued by the Furies, and that's what we sometimes feel like when we do fair use doctrine. It's a bit of a morass, but it is central to American law. So it's important for you to understand why it exists and where it comes from and what's important about it. Okay, so fair use doctrine exists to balance the incentive function of copyright with crucial social goals. So the Constitution, our US Constitution, which is still standing at this moment, gives people the right to copyright in their exclusive works, the exclusive right to their writings and discoveries. Right. Why? So that we can create and be incentivized to create. It's an economic incentive. What does fair use do? It creates breathing room. It says things that are so socially valuable that copyright might hamper them if we enforced it, will at this moment restrict copyright law and allow this breathing room for the things that we think of as socially beneficial and important. So important that we're going to override copyright law for it. What might that include? Some of our First Amendment rights, the room to speak freely, to criticize, to parody. education, the teaching like we're doing right here in this room, research and scholarship, and access to public resources that might even be embedded in private contexts. So it's a statutory limitation on exclusive rights codified at Section 17107 USC, and it is an affirmative defense for you litigators in the room. Yes, I infringed, but I did it for good, i.e. socially beneficial reasons. So it's a carve-out. It allows certain unauthorized uses of copyright works without permission. It is, and I cannot say this often clearly enough, fact-specific, case-by-case. When I say it's a morass, that is because the cases sometimes go in different directions, but also the analysis of how you balance the factors of fair use can be very complicated indeed. Okay, so what it protects explicitly in the statute, as I said, things like criticism, commentary, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. Through case law, we can add things like parody, expressive, transformative uses. We're going to hear that word a lot tonight. And some non-expressive uses, such as search indexing, possibly text and data mining, possibly LLM training. I think you can see what I'm saying, where we're going from here, right? So, sorry, I'm not looking at the right slide. Someone should have told. Okay. Let us talk then about what is at the heart of fair use. It's a four-factor test. And the four-factor test in Section 107 is everything, right? The courts ask these four questions. What is the purpose and the character of the use? Is it commercial? Is it nonprofit? Is it transformative? That has become increasingly the primary focus of what we're talking about. Factor two, what's the nature of the work? Creative works get more protection. You might be able to understand why. Published works are more permissive than unpublished work. How much of the work is taken? What is the amount? Right. Did you copy all of the work? But also the substantiality of the work, right? Let's say that I write a book called Spare, and in it I have some juicy gossip about the royals. And the only reason really that you want to buy the book is to get the juicy gossip, just get the tea, right? If I copy the juicy gossip in my work, even though maybe a small portion of the work, it's substantial enough to be problematic, right? Then the last factor is the effect on the market for the original work. It's important here to recognize that it's not just the actual market, it's the potential market, right? Does the original work, which has its markets and may have its markets for licensing or other rights exploitation, does that market become impinged by the allegedly infringing work? So potential licensing markets are a problem. This is a little hard to see. Hopefully you can see a little bit of it, but you can see it's a continuum, right? The closer you get to things like commercial use, highly creative works, using the entire work, having a significant market impact, the farther away you get from fair use. And the opposite is also true. Educational use, factual use, using a small portion, little or no impact on the market, much closer to fair use. So where on the continuum do you fall is sort of the determinative question. Transformative use has now become a central inquiry in copyright law. Why? Campbell versus the Cuff Rose is a Supreme Court case in which we started talking really about, does the use add a new purpose or meaning or a message? Now, the word transformative, interestingly, is not in the statute. It is imposed upon the statute in some ways by Pierre Laval, Judge Pierre Laval of the Second Circuit in New York, very influential judge. And he writes an article in the Harvard Law Review talking about the transformative nature of the use in factor one. This starts becoming the big important question. Is it a different character in use? What is the transformative use doing? Parody is an emblematic case. So I raise this just so you can see. Roy Orbison writes a very famous song, Oh Pretty Woman. If you've seen the movie, that is the song that's played in it. Two Live Crew comes along and writes a parody of it called Oh Hairy Woman with rather raunchy lyrics. And they're making fun of the trope of the underlying song, looking at a woman walking down the street and saying, hey, won't you come back with me? And they're making fun of that. And the court, this goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, that is transformative. That is emblematically transformative. It is giving a new meaning and a new message to the work. That's expressive transformation, commentary, criticism, or parody. There's also functional or instrumental transformation, right? Non-expressive repurposing of the work. Like I said before, for search or for indexing or for data extraction purposes. Courts care most about factors one and factor four. Factor one, because of this transformative analysis, right? And factor four, use a market harm because copyright is economic. So this really becomes a question of how do we view what the market is? How do we view what transformative, how transformative the work is? What is the balancing test that we're going to do? This is a highly flexible doctrine. It's a safety valve. It's complicated. Let me give you one more second on U.S. copyright law, and then we will move on. How do we establish infringement in the United States? To prove copyright, you have to show ownership of a valid copyright, copying of original elements of the work, obviously were elements that are in the public domain, not protectable. Then there is a test called the substantial similarity test, which I'll come in a moment, and that protectable expression, of course, was taken. Facts, other things that are non-protectable cannot be part of the substantial similarity analysis. What is that analysis? You take the original work and you compare it with the allegedly infringing work and you go, how close are they? That's the simplest way I can put it. And it's a two-part analysis, right? First, you're going to look, let's just say it's a book, right? You look at the elements of the book, the plot, the sequence events, the character, the dialogue. And then there's an intrinsic test where you look at the works as a whole. How close does this work come to that other work, right? You need a high degree of similarity, and it gets even higher if it's there's no access that's provable. I personally think that substantial similarity will be a very challenging hurdle for plaintiffs to clear in the generative AI cases. Why? Because if they can't establish that generative AI's outputs are substantially similar to their works, they will have a hard time making a case for infringement. This is potentially problematic. There may be ways out, but it's not entirely straightforward. Okay, let me move to the pre-generative AI landscape. We'll give you yet another quick trot through the pre-generative AI landscape. Two things I want to talk about. First, I want to talk about mass digitization cases. It's a word that's just as hard as saying as like anthropomorphic or something, right? Google Books and Sega are the two cases here that I just want to talk about for 2 seconds. A series of mass digitization cases have been cited, especially by defendants, as a way to think about fair use in the AI context, right? The courts in some of these cases draw a line between services that find authorized copies of copyrighted works and those that distribute them. And they also ask again, remember I said in one of the factors, right? What is the purpose and the character of the use? Factor one. In Authors Guild versus Google, which is easily remembered as the Google Books case. So what does Google Books do? Google Books takes all the books, digitizes them. You're searching for a book that you're interested in. It'll give you a snippet, as they call it, 3 sentences from that book. And you think, oh, yes, this is the book that I was looking for. And then you can go and find the book on your own. And it points you to where the book is. It does not at any point reproduce the entire book. What does the court say in that case? Entire work copied. Why is that not problematic? Google says we need to copy the entire work in order to make it accessible to people. We need to store it. We need to be able to break it into these snippets. And the court says, yes, you're right. And the court says, yes, there's a socially beneficial use. What's the socially beneficial use? You and I can actually go search this database and find the book that we're looking for. So intermediate copying in this case becomes functionally necessary. Similar case, similar or analogous situation in Sega versus Applied and Sony versus Kinectics, where the copying of something copyrighted is necessary to gain access to the ideas and functional elements, right? To facilitate the creation of a non-infringing work. That may be fair use under the Ninth Circuit. Those are two incredibly important cases. One more point, which is really important in the pre-gen AI landscape, and then we'll get to the first big pre-gen AI case, is this case, Warhol v. Goldsmith, comes down in the Supreme Court in 2023. Huge case, one of the biggest copyright cases. We don't have that many, actually. We have Campbell versus Cuffrose in 1994. We have this case in 2023. What's the story here? On your left is a picture by Lynn Goldsmith. She's a photographer in the 1980s. She takes a picture of the young artist known as Prince. Prince is blowing up. He's becoming huge. Vanity Fair runs a story on Prince, and they're really fascinated because he's becoming a huge deal artist. And they commission Lynn Goldsmith's photograph, one licensed use for Andy Warhol, the great artist, to make some silk screens based on that photograph. One licensed use. They run the photograph of Warhol, the silk screen, in their article on Prince. Prince dies 10 years later. Vanity Fair now wants to write a cover story because, of course, Prince has become one of the biggest artists of all time in the 80s. And tragically early death, big story. They run it on the cover, but they run it with an unlicensed use. Unbeknownst to people, Andy Warhol had made multiple silkscreens. As you know, he often does that. And this is an unlicensed use. Goldsmith finds out about it and says, no, I never gave permission for that. Goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. Really, they go at it hammer and tongs. You should read the opinion. It's wonderful to hear two justices sort of lobbying grenades at each other. But what basically happens in this case is the majority says, look, for there to be a transformative use, the use must have a further purpose or a different character. And it must be weighed against other considerations, like commercialism. So the same copying may be fair in one purpose, but not in another. So now we realize not only we have to ask how is the copyrighted work used and changed, or whether or not it's changed, but why? What is the purpose of the copying here? In this case, in the Warhol case, what the court essentially says is used to illustrate prints in a magazine article about prints, used for the same purpose in the same commercial context. Substitution effect, right? Lynn Goldsmith loses potential licensing revenues. When that happens, this is not fair use. It's a really important case. So we have cases going different ways. In summary, we've got our Authors Guild versus Google, the Google Books case, saying sometimes it can be transformative, even when it's in a commercial context. We have Warhol versus Goldsmith saying, nah, don't think so, when it's commercial context and it's used for the same purpose in the same market and creates potential market harm, problematic. The AI cases are really going to raise these same questions, whether training is transformative or non-expressive. What's the liability for outputs that resemble the copyrighted works? What is the role of licensing markets in the factor for analysis? Again, market harm, potential or actual. And then other issues, intermediate copying is a big one. Was it done in good faith? How do we train the data sets? What are the nature of the outputs and so forth? Hopefully this will become clearer as we move along. I'm going to go now to the first big pre-generative AI case that has absolutely direct implications on the Gen AI cases, and that is Thomson Reuters versus Ross Intelligence. You can't see it all that well, but here is a picture of a headnote and a keynote from Westlaw. Westlaw is owned by Thomson Reuters. It's a database, a legal database that you can search. I don't know, do you have it here? You do have it. Okay, so you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? You can look at the little headnotes and they'll tell you things about the case. You can look at the keynotes and you can search on the case, right? A proprietary system owned by Westlaw, and they claim extremely expensive to develop, right? And Ross comes to them and says, we'd like to license your system to create a competitor to you, to create yet another searchable legal database. And Thomson Reuters says, why would we do that? Why would we license our work so that you could create a direct competitive work? And they say no. Ross then goes around and does a contract with a third party legalese to train the Ross AI. Thomson Reuters sues in the District of Delaware. Okay, the first question is originality. Are the headnotes and keynotes original enough? Judge Bibas, who I think very highly of, I had him at Penn and I think he's absolutely brilliant. He's also very meticulous. So what does he do? He literally reads about 5,000 headnotes. Personally, I think I'd kill myself if I had to do that. But hey, good for you, Judge Bibas. And he says at least 2,000 and something of these are original enough. They pass the question of originality, right? So they are, in fact, copyrighted. Well, they are, in fact, original, right? Now, copying, yeah, I think so. And then the court applies the substantial similarity test. And it says, yeah, these headnotes that Thomson Reuters are creating and the Ross headnotes are, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable. They're exactly the same. Let me just remind you of this four-factor test again. The purpose of the character of the use, commercial. Is it transformative? Come back to that. Nature of the copyrighted work. Some of these are barely creative enough. They're headnotes. They're not novels, right? The amount taken, all of it, and then the effect on the market for the original, one of the big ticket questions. So factor one. The use is commercial and not transformative. Factor one, weighs against fair use. Factor two, creativity. Not particularly creative. Weighs for fair use, perhaps not a very significant factor in the analysis. Factor three, okay, how much is made available to the public? Okay, that's sort of the question. The court tips it to Ross. Factor four is the big ticket question. court determines that the original market, legal research platforms, and a potential derivative market is data to train AI. What do I mean by that? Thomson Reuters could contract with an AI company to create AI training, right? That is a potential market. Now, the courts have gone both ways on that question. It's a very, it's one that's going to be, I think, disputed quite a bit. But factor four weighs against fair use. This case is now an interlocutory appeal in the Third Circuit. I'm actually working on an amicus brief on that if anyone's interested in it, which is a lot, but it's really interesting stuff. Here's what I want you to take away from Thomson Reuters versus Ross. These are some of the questions we're going to be asking in Gen AI. Is the tool free or is it subscription-based? Does the output attempt to substitute for the original works? Does the output add commentary or does it repurpose the originals? Factor one, big questions. Factor two, is the work computer code or something more creative? Factor three, does the tool restrict the extent to which the original works are reproduced? Does the tool solely reproduce the artist's style or copyrightable expression? And factor four, are people using the tools to create output instead of buying the original work? Those are some of the questions that I think we have already seen coming up through the AI cases. All right, that's a lot, I know, and there's even more to come. So buckle up. Survey and analysis of the Gen AI training cases. There are about 47 cases now, I think. I've lost track of counting, honestly. And fair use is likely to be a pivotal issue in these cases, whether or not they result in decisions, settlements, what have you. So the two big ones are Barst versus Anthropic and Cadre versus Meta. And I want to think about how we think about those decisions and what lies ahead. So case one is Barst v. Anthropic. Sorry, that's a pretty pathetic picture of Andrea Barst, but it's all I could find. The named author, and Dario Amodei, the CEO of Anthropic. So what does the court say? Anthropic's use of the works to train its models. Fair use. They also made electronic copies of the works to build a permanent central library, as they called it, for unspecified future uses. Now, let's just recall that this case has been working its way through the courts for about, 8 years, I think, maybe more. So how the arguments are being made today might be somewhat different from what you're seeing here. You might be surprised by some of this, the admission that they made a permanent electronic library, for example. But the court holds fair use for works that it had purchased to train on, not fair use for works that it had trained on from these unauthorized libraries called shadow libraries. Anyone who doesn't know what a shadow library is, these are these gigantic mass digitization sites that have that basically do an end run around copyright. I don't know how they obtain the works, but they don't always pay for them. In fact, mostly they don't ever pay for them, right? And they make them available to you and me for free. Some people think that's taboo, and I don't. But training on these pirated sites becomes a question in and of itself. Okay, so let's rip through this analysis here. Factor one, purpose and character of the use. Oh, interesting. The court says it's quintessentially transformative, not just transformative, but really transformative, right? So they say, listen, this is a use that's super new and interesting and important, right? So the court also says, when human authors read works, that is also transformative. They may need to pay for the work when they use it the first time, but to make them pay for it every time they use it is unthinkable. Well, is that the right analogy? We'll come back to that. Factor two, some expressive elements, weighs against fair use. Factor three, here we go. Copying the works was reasonably necessary for the transformative use. What really matters is how much of those copied works are made public. And if no Anthropic model output infringes a training work, then none of the copied works is made public, weighs in favor of fair use. Factor four, this is critical. There was no cognizable effect on the market for the training works, and copyright only protects works against substantially similar works. Okay, the output question I was raising earlier. So on the assumption that no output of A's models is substantially similar to plaintiff's works, there cannot be any relevant marginal effect. It doesn't matter. This is super important, right? It does not matter that the models will generate outputs that compete with the plaintiff's works. It's not the competition, in other words, that matters here. It's the substantial similarity test. As long as they're not substantially similar, that competition is not relevant to copyright or fair use. So let me give you an illustration. right? In case this is confusing to you or you don't quite get what it's getting at, right? I write cozy mysteries. It's a cozy mystery. Oh, it's set in like 1930, you know, in a beautiful English manor house, and has a little feel of Agatha Christie, The Butler Always Did It. Yeah, they're cute. People love to read them. They, you know, it's a fun hour read instead of watching Netflix, right? So great. AI generates 5,000 of those a day. Completely and totally competing with my market, undermining my market. Does it matter? Well, here, according to Judge Alsup, no. Yes, it has a competitive effect, but are any of those works substantially similar to my work? They might be. They might have some elements of my work, right? They may have the butler doing, they may have the beautiful house, they may have the cast of complicated characters, or maybe even stereotypical characters, who knows? But it doesn't come close enough to my work. And if it doesn't come close enough to my work, it is not substitutable for my work, right? So competition effect is not the question here. So here's a consistent theme. If you copy works only to make and distribute other works that are not substantially similar, that is not within the scope of copyright protection and is therefore fair use. This is a broad intermediate copying theory. I think it's not really consistent with how we treat human authors, and Judge Alsup doesn't really explain the inconsistency, right? If I walk into Heffer's and I decide I want to read one of those books, but I can't really afford it, and it just so happens that they have a lovely photocopy machine in the back, and I go and photocopy it, and I walk out with my photocopy, I don't think that's treated, despite the fact that I'm not distributing, as a non-infringing use. So let's leave that question on the table. What happens is, in his ruling, Judge Alsup rules as follows. He grants summary judgment in relation to Anthropic's use of the copies of the author's work, finding these, as I said, quintessentially transformative and thus fair. As the models were trained not to replicate or supplant the works, but to turn a hard corner and create something different. The AI models used the book to learn patterns and generate new text, but did not reproduce or distribute the original works. Judge Alsup grants summary judgment in relation to Anthropic's conversions of lawfully printed purchase copies to digital use, which he also says is transformative, added no new copies, eased storage, and enabled searchability, was therefore also fair use. Notice this important twist, though. He denies summary judgment in relation to Anthropic's copying of pirated works. Anthropic employees had said in discovery, this comes out, right, that copies of the works included prior runs would be retained forever. Alsup says no. Copying off of a pirate site has already constituted infringement. It's compounding the infringement. The infringement occurs already by the pirate site, and then you're compounding it by copying from the pirate site. This is going to become incredibly breaking news as of September 25th. I know it doesn't sound like it's that breaking, but it is, because this is continuing and there are new developments even as of today. Anthropic agrees to pay $1.5 billion for its past use of pirated books. Now you see why this is important, right? Statutory damages on a per-work basis, $3,100 per book for each of the half a million copyrighted works alleged to be downloaded. They agree to destroy the pirated libraries and any derivative copies, and they have to confirm that that has occurred. This does not shield Anthropic from future lawsuits by authors whose works do not form part of this class. That's important to note. And it's also important, I think, to note that this is the first of its kind, and it's setting a benchmark, in my view, for other copyright lawsuits, especially ones that involve the similar effects to the defendant's use of the shadow libraries. So if other lawsuits follow suit, and importantly, if plaintiffs are allowed to amend their complaints to include a separate count of pirated libraries, of training on pirated libraries, I think we should expect to see more of these claims coming up. And I think we should expect the plaintiffs to see at least $1.5 billion, because there's a statutory damages that sets what that's at. And indeed, I think my point is proven by Concord Music versus Anthropic, which hopefully I'll have time to talk about a little bit later. Here, this contra what I just said, Judge Yumi Lee says, no, you may not amend the complaint to add this new claim of copyright infringement based on Anthropic's alleged bit torrenting or streaming of these files of works from shadow libraries. This is a victory for Anthropic, in my view, but it is not the last time that we will see a motion to amend based on training shadow libraries. Okay, I'm going to come back to those a little bit later when I do a little bit of comparative looking at these two cases. But let me continue my flight through the course, the courses that I've laid for you tonight. Cadre v. Meta, the other really big case here. As you can see on your left, this is Richard Cadre, some of his books, and obviously Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Meta. Let's go through the four-factor test again. The purpose here, Meta's purpose, highly transformative. Guess who we hear echoes of, right? Judges Alsup and Chabria agree. Work is highly transformative here. They seem very taken by the technology and its transformative, its transformativeness, its capacity to transform. And LLM ingests sort of statistical patterns. This is now not, sorry, how a human reads a book. Okay. And by creating a tool that anyone can use, Meta's copying has the potential to exponentially multiply creative expression in a way that teaching individual people does not. Okay, this very much aligns with what the defendants had pled. Meta's use is commercial, but that is not determinative. Their use of unauthorized copies from shadow libraries is potentially relevant, but not here, because bad faith is not really a factor in the fair use test. And plaintiffs haven't shown that Meta's use actually benefited the shadow libraries. Now, that one, I'm sorry, I take exception to. Because when, in fact, the plaintiffs do train on the shadow libraries not only advertise it, they start subscription models saying, hey, look, the AI models are training on us. And if you, other company, like, let's say, Perplexity or whomever else, want to do a deal with us, we will. Look how well it's worked. So benefited, I think, actually does happen. Judge Chabria. The factor two, the works are expressive. Meta does take advantage of that, weighs against fair use. Factor three, copying of the works, reasonably necessary in light of its transformative purpose, weighs in favor of fair use and aligns with Judge Alls. Okay, factor four, the market harm. This is very interesting, y'all, for several reasons. For one, he says the market harm is relevant to the fourth factor is not limited to harm from substantially similar works. Divergent, right? Harm from market dilution, production of works that cause plaintiffs' works to lose sales, even though not substantially similar, counts. Okay, here is a different theory, right? Of ultimate importance is whether the author's incentive to create will be undermined. So you can see he's really leaning on this economic analysis. So his general view is copying should be allowed as long as it doesn't undercut incentives to create, but not if it does undercut those incentives, right? It's less likely to undercut if the purpose of the use is different than the original purpose of the work. Nonetheless, copyright should be allowed because it has social benefits. This is sort of a Solomonic decision in some ways. It's interesting. Judge Chabria says, you need to be able to show and you need to show that your particular works lost value due to competition from outputs. And here, plaintiffs, you did not show that. Okay. He says most copyright owners should be able to do that. I think that his examples cast doubt on how easy that will actually be. Again, a cozy romance or a cozy mystery or a romance or a historical romance or romantasy. If anybody who reads any of these books knows, you can admit it. It's totally okay, right? They are different genres in some ways, or they're sliced by publishers, sliced and diced as different genres. Are they the same market? How do you talk about what the market is? Also, how do you certify a class, right? If each book has a different market and that's central to fair use, has Judge Chabria just foreclosed all class action? I want to stick a pin in this thought. Market dilution is a relatively novel and untested theory. It's been raised by the U.S. Copyright Office, but really hasn't been litigated in the U.S. courts yet. And Chabria sort of raises this on his own de novo. And I think that the plaintiffs and defendants were a little like, hey, where is this coming from, right? I mean, if I were a plaintiff, I'd be excited in some ways, especially if I were a plaintiff in the next case on. But it really is sort of this is a new thing. Okay, he grants partial summary judgment to Meta, finding that the use was fair use. He faults the plaintiffs for not presenting sufficient evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact that the LLM would create market dilution of their works. Again, I don't think something plaintiffs could have anticipated that they needed to do, but basically he says if this happens in future cases. They just have a pretty strong leg to stand on. And then he states in dicta that in most cases, AI training on copyrighted works will likely be illegal due to market dilution. And he spends a lot of time in his opinion, which is a relatively long opinion, developing this theory of market harm. Appeal to the Third Circuit is pending. I and several of my colleagues filed an amicus brief in April of the copyright law professors. I'm happy to give you that. I want to spend a couple of minutes doing a comparative analysis of these two cases, because these really are the big cases that we have right now. So, Judge Alsup and transformative use, altering the first with new expression, meaning, or message. What is he saying? As long as you're learning from works to create new works that are not substantially similar, any copying is fair use. Okay. So sure about that? Okay, but this is what he says. So, unclear, even if you take his premise, that it is fair use, right? And that we don't want to charge people every single time they use the work. It's unclear to me why still training on shadow libraries where you've never purchased the work or you've never licensed the work is still constitutes fair. Judge Chhabria, transformative purpose. The purpose for which the works are being used is relevantly different than that for which the works were created. Going back to the Google Books case, right? I'm not using this to substitute for your book. It also goes to the Warhol case. I didn't put it in the slide, but why? Because it's being used for a different purpose and a different market. Sort of squaring with what Warhol requires for transformativeness. Judge Chhabria opines that Meta is using work to discover statistical patterns, as I say. So I think what he's assuming, could be wrong, is that we humans, we assimilate and learn propositional knowledge, right? This is how we sort of work. And the algorithms just build models of word relationships and frequencies. I am not entirely persuaded. We humans also engage in unconscious and implicit learning. We learn. How did you learn grammar? How did you learn speech? By reading, by learning from texts. You also learned not just the facts that were ascribed to the author was putting in there, but also how is language structured? We learn implicitly as well. And he says, oh, well, you know, users can ask a llama to edit an email or translate an excerpt into a foreign language or write a skit, so on and so forth. Right. The purpose of the plaintiff's books, by contrast, is to be read for entertainment or education. That does not, in fact, in my view, present the contrast that he thinks it does. Right? Quick example. Right. Someone makes an infringing copy of a work on bookkeeping and learns how to keep books from it. The actual damages are going to be limited to the price of the book. It does not include the defendant's income from bookkeeping. Injunction is limited to prohibiting further copying, maybe destroying the infringing copy made. It does not stop the defendant from bookkeeping. Okay, so reading for the purpose of learning bookkeeping is in fact that kind of training, but I really don't think we can call it transformative as the statute would have us read it. So I'm not entirely persuaded, but be that as it may, Judges Alsup's and Chhabria's approaches follow from their general view of the scope and the goals of copyright protection. Alsup, no relevant effect on the markets if generative AI outputs are not substantially similar to training works. Chhabria, relevant effect on the market if you can prove that the outputs dilute the market for a particular work. I'm going to just interpolate my view for a moment, as I've done all along. I tend to think that if the use isn't transformative and is of the whole work, I'm not even sure we really need to ask about the effect on the potential market. The defendant has, in fact, deprived the plaintiff of revenue from one or more of the copies. This, I think, is squarely within 107. I think there is actual market harm. I also think there's potential market harm, but I don't think there has been enough sort of acknowledgement of the fact that there is actual market harm. Okay, as to the training on shadow libraries, this is a topic that's just near and dear to my heart, so I have to spend a minute on it, right? Arguably, most, if not all, of the AI companies are training on pirated data sets or shadow libraries. LibGen, Books3, Anna's Archives, and so forth. Under Alsup's decision, acquiring the pirated copies would probably be treated as infringing. Okay. Unclear whether he would still say that if they didn't build a permanent library. By contrast, Just Chabria says the pirate copies can be justified if they were just used to train the LLM as he found Meta did, irrespective of whether or not they're stored. Okay, Chabria spends all this time on the market dilution theory, which might in fact say, well, it's the diluting the market harm, the potential market harm that counts. Nonetheless, shadow libraries have become increasingly a preoccupation of people who say, well, if we can't stop AIs from training on everything, let's at least stop it from training on these shadow libraries. The US has spent a lot of time and money trying to shut down these libraries, but of course, it's a game of whack-a-mole, as we like to call it. So we have the proposed legislation called the AI Accountability and Personal Data Protection Act. And I testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee this summer on that act in favor of it. And we have the TRAIN Act, Transparency and Responsibility for Artificial Networks, Artificial Intelligence Networks Act. So it is a concern, sort of in a larger picture story, not just a legal one, but it's also something that I think we're going to see bubbling up in the case. Okay, so last part on the Gen AI case, and I'll give you some a few more of my thoughts. Recent developments and pending cases. I just thought you might enjoy a very quick spin, because obviously everything I'm doing is quick today, but I thought you might just enjoy seeing some of the other cases that are working their way through the courts. The biggest one probably is In Re Open AI copyright infringement litigation. It's an MDL or multi-district litigation, meaning it's the consolidation of 12 lawsuits against OpenAI, 8 in the Southern District of New York, including New York Times versus Microsoft. Microsoft was a named party, less so now, and 4 in the Northern District of California. And Judge Sidney Stein is presiding, and that is coming up. The dates on that have been pushed forward a little bit. On October 27th, Magistrate Judge Wang allowed the plaintiff's discovery related to OpenAI's alleged use of LibGen, another huge shadow library. Very interesting. On October 28th, in a second opinion, Judge Stein issues an order denying OpenAI's motion to dismiss the class plaintiff's claim as to infringing outputs. In other words, right, we now have, well, let me just say, yeah, Judge Stein allows the class plaintiff's theory of infringement based on downloading copies as a separate claim of infringement apart from training, downloading from shadow libraries, another claim. I think that proves my point about amending complaints. The class plaintiffs now in OpenAI have 3 distinct theories of infringement: downloading from shadow libraries claim, the training model claim, and the output claim. You can see why this is going to be a huge case, right? Everything that we talked about is on the table now, right? On the other hand, I think that OpenAI has its work cut out for it, right? So even if you win on your fair use training, you have to win on the shadow library claim by convincing the judge that you're treating this download as part of the purpose of training, as Judge Chabria ruled in Cadre v. Meta. Okay. If Judge Stein follows Judge Alsup's approach in Bartz v. Anthropic, I think we could see another class settlement ensue, possibly with a similar finding of statutory damages. So this would not add statutory damages, but again, this would be huge. And I think it's really interesting to ask, where is this going? I don't think I have any predictions for us. Anyone does right now, but stay tuned. Okay, I just want us to enjoy a couple seconds of other cases, because Cadre v. Meta, Bartz, these are books. Books are great, right? But there's other things in the creative universe. Images. Disney and Universal against Midjourney, and Warner Brothers against Midjourney. And literally, like yesterday, I had to update this slide because these two cases have now been consolidated. What do these cases entail? All right, maybe this will look familiar to you. Which, if you didn't have a little language at the top, would you know which one was Midjourney's output and which was copyrighted characters by Disney? Not so much, right? So, is a picture worth 1,000 words? I don't know. I tend to like words a lot. But I do think that in a case like this where you're going to have it go to a jury and it is so visible what can be done, it's a bit like Sora 2. I think there's a benefit to that evidentiary sort of ease at which you can show it. There are also cases involving music, notably the case of Concord Music versus Anthropic, UMG, Universal Music Group versus Udio, Justice versus Udio, GEMA versus Udio and Coda v. Suno. Those last two are, Suno. Those last two cases are international cases, and I'm not as clear about them. But in the first two, Suno and Udio are music generating platforms, and the allegations are fairly similar in these cases, again, that the music generation system used copyrighted sound recordings without authorization to train its models. So they're talking about what they call mass infringement. Really interesting development, in my view. October 29th, UMG and Udio settle. And just yesterday or today, the parties filed a voluntary stipulation of dismissal. What does that mean? Really interesting. I don't think we know exactly what it means yet. Udio has agreed to enter into new licensing agreements with UMG for the use of UMG's recorded music catalog and its publishing rights. It's restructuring. It's going to train unauthorized and licensed music. It's going to provide a licensed and protected environment for users to create, stream, remix, share music within the platform. For the moment, it's remaining a walled garden, as they say. Stricter controls, fingerprinting, filtering, and so forth. They haven't disclosed how much the settlement entails, and they really haven't disclosed the terms of the settlement, which I suspect is still being hashed out. So this is the first major resolution of this kind of the copyright infringement cases involving generative AI music platforms. UMG's claims against Udio still remain ongoing for other labels. It doesn't necessarily resolve those, but it signals a shift from this unauthorized mass use towards potentially, I should have said perhaps potentially, a licensing-based model for AI music generation, at least for UMG. And I think it'll be really interesting and important to see if more licensing agreements of this nature continue to emerge. Okay, latest development in Concord Music versus Anthropic. I only give you this for one taste of what's going, right? Anthropic is saying, look, you guys can put your experts on our site and find, you can create a set of prompts and do it over and over again until you find something that smacks of substantially similar infringing use, right? Is that how people like you and I and people who just use this platform actually use it? Is it that easy for people? Is it even possible for people to come up with absolutely substantially similar infringing outputs? And the court says, yes, Anthropic, we actually agree with you that the burden of proof is on the plaintiff, and the standard has to be that they have to show, right, that infringing lyrics can be produced by Claude, not just by these very complicated set of prompts, but actually in the way that people would use it. There are cases involving software. I'm not going to spend any time on them. I'm trying very hard to stay within my time limitations, Lionel. I hope you appreciate this. So I do want to spend 3 minutes about thoughts on what lies. I'm going to be wildly speculative here, so I haven't been throughout this entire presentation. But to me, this is the fun part because we ask ourselves all the time, like, where are we going to see the sticky places? Where are we going to see the interesting, complicated, thorny questions get sorted out? And how is that going to happen? I think that on outputs, the substantial similarity test is just clearly a hurdle. Proving that outputs are substantially similar will require showing that users can readily generate infringing works. I didn't say on that line there also that the works, in fact, are infringing, that they are substantially similar. They clear that hurdle. And I think, you know, not just that it's possible to generate one with a million prompts if you really architect it properly, right? And this is a tough test to meet. And I'm not sure it's so, if it's so possible to do. I think the similarity of outputs is going to be tough. And there's a lot of outputs. And I think that some people have made arguments that copyright should be expanded to comprise copyright and style. I know. Personally, I'm not a fan. We could talk about that later. One of our members of the audience is laughing at me because she does think so, or maybe is talking about it. So this is going to be contested for sure. And we can certainly see where that's going. Fair use, I think that courts, at least at the moment, are seem inclined to allow training as a transformative use. I am so not going to talk about Getty V Stability AI here because it's a 200-page opinion that dropped like 3 days ago. And alas, I have not only not read it, but that is my weekend sorted. So, but, you know, if that's happening here as well. Okay, what does that mean? The big question, in my view, is then going to turn to, is there market harm? And there's still a lot of hurdles, as I think I've suggested so far, right? I've intimated, even though the market can be actual or potential, how do you draw said market? By genre? By comparative metrics or comparable metrics in revenues and audience? How do you measure damages? How do you certify a class if you're going to have class action suit? I think there's going to be, of course, gaming in the market analysis. The market dilution theory raised by Judge Chhabria is really interesting. And I do think that if the courts are willing to entertain, very promising for plaintiffs, perhaps I should just say potentially promising for plaintiffs, unclear what exactly that is, market dilution. I mean, yes, I know that it's competition in the same market, but it's really not been tested. So we don't know how the courts are, what the parameters are going to be in the courts. Last point, training on shadow libraries and willful or intentional copying. So bad faith hasn't really been a thing, okay? But it has from time to time been taken seriously as part of the infringement analysis. Courts do sometimes take it into consideration. I would argue, and I think I've given this away, so it won't be a surprise to you, the training on shadow libraries should be treated as intrinsically bad faith, because the works have been infringed by being placed in the library, and infringement is compounded when the works are used to train AI. In my view, it's a double infringement, and it should be penalized. Okay, maybe I just have a dog in this hunt. I have a book, as Lionel said, and it has, in fact, been found its way to many shadow libraries, thereby depriving me of like at least 10 Starbucks coffees, and I am miffed about that, right? So, you know, this matters to impecunious academic, but more what matters, I think, is that these are massive, massive pirate libraries, right? We're not talking about a small amount of works. It is an entire end run around copyright. Now you're not even training on copyrighted works. Now you're not even potentially having a licensing agreement with copyright owners and copyright holders. Now you're doing a complete end run around copyright. And I find that inexcusable. Licensing deals. I've been surprised that most more licensing deals haven't been struck, but it is, of course, early days. My guess is that hammering down the terms of payment, recurring use, things like that are part of the challenge. What do you do with back catalogs, as in music? Hugely lucrative back catalogs. What about the use of images? Do you have the right to go across media? Rights of publicity and name, image, likeness deals may offer us some interesting pointers on that. I'm not going to talk about intermediate liability. Cox v. Sony Communications certiorari has been granted by the Supreme Court. Really interesting question. I just signed on to an amicus brief on that. I could talk about that with anyone interested. I'm sure there won't be, but I would be happy to if you'd like. Two questions. Are books somehow different than images, music, creative works, where at least the ordinary observer, which is the test for substantial similarity, can perceive copying? Should we have different answers or different standards for different areas? That is not something we typically do, obviously, in copyright law, but who knows? And then my last query, which I really have been thinking about a lot lately and I have no answers to, is copyright law the right tool for governing generative AI? So in the U.S., we are about to hit the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976. Kind of makes me feel old just to say that because I've been in it for a long time. But is it time for a refresh? Should we hit the reset button? Or should we follow our current course in the U.S. of pretty much no regulation and just let the market decide, whatever that means, right? And in some ways, that is sort of consonant with the way that law works. We tend to look backward, as you know, not forward. And I don't know if this is provocative, but I would suggest that copyright law might actually work pretty well. The fair use test is a very fact-intensive and specific and granular test. And I actually think that many of its prongs do, you can map what's happening with Gen AI on it in some ways. It's not a perfect fit, no question about it. But I think that we have some tools in our toolbox with which to address the question of how to treat this kind of mass training. But of course, the devil is, as always, in the details. So I want to thank you all for paying attention to this extremely long and fast production. And also, I really welcome your questions both now or afterwards. I have put in the PowerPoints my my email address. Feel free to email me or just grab me because I love talking about this. Thank you so much.